Hello, I'm Monsignor Jim Lasanti. Today, I'm personally speaking, I'll be joined by actor and singer Andy Mientis. Andy's best known for starring in the Broadway musical Spring Awakening and Les Miserables, and most recently in the hit CW series The Flash. Please stay with us. Welcome to Personally Speaking. I'm your host, Monsignor Jim Lasanti. An actor, singer, composer, and writer, Andy Mientis joins me now. Andy starred on Broadway in Spring Awakening and made his Broadway debut as Marius in the revival of Les Miserables. He's well known for his starring role on the NBC series Smash and as the villain Harley Rathaway, also known as Pied Piper, on the CW hit series The Flash. Andy has written a series of books for young people ages 10 through 14 called The Backstagers. He's here with us today to talk about his life, his career, his latest projects, and the values that sustain him. Please join me now as we listen to Personally Speaking with Andy Mientis. Before we get to our interview with Andy, let's listen to him singing a cover of the Dolly Parton song called Wildflowers.
The hills were alive with wildflowers, and I was as wild, even wilder than they. For at least I could run, they just died in the sun, and I refused to just wither in place. Just a wild mountain rose needing free to grow, so I ran, fearing not where I'd go. When a flower grows wild, it can always survive. Wildflowers don't care where they grow.
Andy, thanks for coming on our show.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Are we still in the church?
We're still in the church. I'm sitting just beneath the belfry, actually. It's okay. Where my little office is. And so someday I'll have a little staircase so you can get up to it and look out over the land. But right now it's just a weird empty space where there's probably like dead birds and stuff. I haven't been up there in a long time.
Now, for our listeners around the country, Andy, he mentioned to us that he's living in a church. Where is the church, and how in the world did you come to be the owner of a church?
It's a great question. The church is in the Hudson Valley of New York State, it's a couple of hours north of New York City. And I own it with my husband, and we found this place because we used to live in Los Angeles. We had a house there that we owned, and then we like rented a small crash pad in the city, and we were very much bi-coastal. And then around Spring Awakening, the revival of Spring Awakening, when Michael's directing career really took off, and I had attempted to live in Los Angeles for several years before that, and every time I got there, something pulled me back to the city. Like, first it was the Les Miserables revival. Like, I was in LA for maybe 5 months, and then suddenly back in New York for a year working on that. And then as soon as that closed, I actually shot a pilot, which was meant to, like, had it gone to series, I would have been shooting that in New York. And while I was waiting to hear if that was going to series, I did the Deaf West production of Spring Awakening in LA, which then transferred to Broadway. And so I was back in New York. So I kept being pulled back to New York, was never in LA in our home. And then Michael's directing career took off, and suddenly we're in New York all the time. We were renting out our house to various friends in LA, and that was quite stressful to be landlords essentially when we were so far away and couldn't deal with things. And ultimately we were like, we have to get rid of this house, and do something on the East Coast. And, so we talked about getting an apartment, but we love our little apartment, and we would not have been able to afford an apartment in the neighborhood that we want to live in. So then we got to talking about maybe something in the country, because we had some friends up here that we were fond of visiting, had some great weekends. And so we just did a broad search in a broad region. of the Hudson Valley and found a church for sale and as a residence. And it looked really magical and there was lots of space and it was actually quite affordable as far as like homes go. And we visited it and fell in love with it. And now here we are.
Isn't that great? I love it. I'm very jealous. I mean, I live in a church too, but it's a different kind of relationship.
Sure.
Andy, we talked a couple of years ago at 54 Below when you were appearing there. And I said to you that a lot of parents, grandparents I deal with, they want to be understanding. They want to be kind and good about kids that may have questions about their own identity. And I said to you, how do they find their way to acceptance and tolerance? And you said, more importantly than acceptance or tolerance is embrace. And I want to go back over that because I've used that in a lot of talks I've used since, the idea of tolerance being just kind of condescending and acceptance being okay, but that embrace being a real sign of true love, that whoever you are, I love you as God made you. How did you come to that particular concept of embrace, and how do people get there? Like if a mom or dad are listening to me right now and are wondering, I think my kid has some issues with identity, but I'm not sure how to approach it or how to approach them. What's the key to getting to embrace?
Yeah, I think talking about tolerance, you just have to imagine being told that you're tolerated. And how does that feel? You know what I mean? It has a certain connotation, doesn't it? Like we tolerate a chilly room or like a noisy neighbor, or we tolerate things that are quite unpleasant. And we accept things that we can't change sort of begrudgingly. That's when you talk about acceptance. Like, well, my noisy neighbor isn't going to move and I've tried telling them to be quiet and they won't, so I'll just accept it, but it's still quite unpleasant. Mm-hmm. Whereas if my noisy neighbor, I like love their sort of joie de vivre and like the way that they have social gatherings and I like that energy in my neighborhood, and then it becomes something I embrace, that's a nicer thing, isn't it? Like, right. So the idea of telling someone that you tolerate them and who they are doesn't sound so nice. The idea that you accept them doesn't sound so nice, but being able to tell them that, like, not only do I tolerate and accept who you are, I love who you are, that I learn from this, that it enriches my life by knowing you because I can see a new perspective. That's really what people want to hear from the people that they love. You know what I mean? Like, I'm old enough and now, you know, sort of confident enough in my life that it doesn't matter to me so much if people tolerate me or accept me. But when I'm speaking about the people that I love or the people that I work with or the people that I respect, I want that same level of respect and care back, you know, right. Naturally, just in the human exchange of respect. So that's I think the difference between those terms. And I hope that makes sense to people.
Now let's go back. The person that you love, Michael, I see in an interview where he said that early on knew who he was, kind of very comfortable with it way early. Yours comes a little bit later. What's it like to be in love with someone whose journey has been not exactly parallel?
It's informative and it's enriching. You know, I think that in certain couplings, whether we're talking about like experiences of embracing an identity, or if we're just talking about like who's the tidy one and who's the creative one, like sometimes people come together when they are really in sync and they're the same person. They can finish each other's sentences. That's a type of coupling that works quite well, I find. And then there's a type of coupling where you get two really like whole individuals who each bring, you know, a specific experience, a specific perspective, and like a specific way they live their life together. And it's enriching to both parties. And so, you know, I definitely found, especially early in our relationship, when a lot of our culture was frankly kind of new to me, which sounds crazy to even think about now because I feel so, you know, fluent in who I am at this point. That was really helpful. It was really something to look to and it's just a bridge for me and an entree into a whole community because I didn't, you know, I had tons of like friends and coworkers who were out queer somewhere in the acronym. But to really find those like close people beyond just acquaintances or even friendships, but real, like that brotherhood that you form. He was instrumental in helping me find that.
Andy, one of our other guests is a congressional candidate, Madison Cawthorn, running for Congress. And when he was about 17 in a serious car accident, and he now is in a wheelchair. But he said that he's happy in some way for the accident and that it moved him from being a person of sympathy to a person of empathy. I mention that because most people would know, looking at you, this healthy young guy, this thing, HNPP, that you've carried in your life, like, what's it done for you in terms of your own empathy?
Quite a lot. It's not something I think about so much. Like, I don't identify as disabled. I have this neurological disorder that is very slowly degenerative and could be a problem for me in the future. Isn't really something terrible day to day for me yet. The biggest issue is that this nerve that holds your shoulder blade in place, mm-hmm. that on me is just shot. Like, that's like the first sort of permanently shot nerve that I have. So thus my shoulder wings out, which causes a lot of tension and pain. And it's really specific nerve pain. It's really hard to kick. And because of the way that these nerves in your shoulder operate, it actually has some spatial things for me. Mm-hmm. I get some vertigo and migraines and all sorts of good stuff. So I deal with that, but I don't yet identify as disabled. However, anybody who has some kind of neurological issue, even, you know, as far as disability, I have a firsthand knowledge of like what it feels like to suddenly have your foot not work. And right. I'm very fortunate in that my foot will work again if mm-hmm. I rest properly. Whereas I know that a lot of people, if they have ALS or if they have MS or something related to what I've got, that those things will just sort of slowly degenerate. And it just, I empathize with that on a different level because I have a personal experience of having the symptom, mm-hmm. but not the cause. And so, you know, I just have that little extra personal touch, which I think opens my eyes in a different way. I wouldn't say like more or less. I think anybody has the capacity for empathy, but it definitely hits home for me where when I, you know, I was just reading about and I watched an interview of Rebecca Luker, who mm-hmm. Is battling ALS, and just her experience, her talking about the way her symptoms manifested and how they progressed, it just really broke my heart specifically because I've been there when you wake up and just your body isn't working in the way that you expect it to, and it seems so unfair, and especially when you're trying to perform. Like I was doing a musical off Broadway a number of years ago. I was doing Carrie at MCC when I was having a particularly bad flare up of my condition, and I was having really terrible vertigo. And it was just a nightmare because I hadn't had a job like that. It was my off Broadway debut and I was still very young and getting started. And this was the biggest opportunity I'd had. And I wasn't present for it because I was just suffering from this thing. And so I just understand those things.
Wow.
And I feel grateful for that because it, you know, I think a lot of people, this is when people talk about privilege, what they're talking about is privilege isn't so much what you have to worry about in your life. It's what you haven't had to worry about in your life. Mm-hmm. You know, that you can just carry on, that like people who have no chronic physical conditions can just get on stage 8 times a week and it's fine. Whereas like others can't. And
right.
So having my eyes open to like just this modicum of what it might be like to have my body not function in a normal way. I obviously understanding that some people have it much worse and battle through much more to get on stage. I'm grateful for that perspective.
Andy, a lot of people who would listen to a show like this probably have seen you on television, but I've had the privilege of seeing you in theater. So I want to ask you a little bit about that. We had earlier today Kyle Smith, who's a film and theater reviewer for National Review, among other things. But I mentioned that because my question to him was, will theater happen again? Will live theater come back? When you've built your life, as you have, in many, many ways in theater, what's your hope in terms of where do we go beyond the pandemic?
I feel very confident that theater will come back. And I actually think that if there had to be a time when we took a pause like this, if this had to come, I think it's actually a blessing that it's come at the same time that we're having this huge conversation about racial justice and about equality and equity in the arts, that we actually have time to examine our system and examine the ways that we can make it better, where it's not this machine that's running that we have to try to like change little cogs here and there, but keeping the machine running and hope that the whole machine runs better. We can actually take the machine apart and put it back together in the way that we want it to go. I feel confident that theater will return when it's safe, because theater has endured so much. Mm-hmm. It's an ancient art form, an absolutely ancient art form, maybe the most ancient art form, you know, that has endured and endured enthusiastically. You know, like until this shutdown, Broadway was doing as well as it had ever done. Financially and in terms of the mainstream, you know, Hamilton sold to Disney Plus for $70 million and had like unbelievable numbers of people tuning into it. So people are interested and people love it. And, you know, it has endured through wars and plagues in the past and economic hardship, depressions, and yet it endures. And so I think there is this instinctual, undeniable, unbreakable hunger for it that will continue as soon as it's able. I think in the meantime, we're all going to have to be a little creative about how we make it work. And there's some really smart people working on that. My hope is that that obviously happens sooner than later, because a lot of people are out of a job and need to get back to work. And my hope is that we use this time to come back better and more equitable than we ever have been, listening to underrepresented people in our community, lifting up our entire community. Right. My only real fear in terms of like, will theater come back, is thinking about the, I'm sure, scores of really talented and worthy and hardworking artists that just won't be able to bridge the gap, that don't have like a safety net to survive through this time, to then like start back up again, auditioning, etc., when things get going again. You know, being an artist is so tenuous as it is. You're living paycheck to paycheck and you're always sort of on the verge of ruin. And so some people have a safety net. They've been lucky to work and have saved up something, or they've got a family that supports them, or they're lucky to have a second career, or they live in a place where they're able to have a day job that can support them. But this is a unique time in that like all of the work has gone away for an extended period of time. All of the artists are living in the most expensive cities in the world. And the jobs that normally support those careers have also gone away. Like the service industry, you know, waiting, you can't wait tables right now.
Right.
And certainly if you hadn't had a day job before because you were doing well enough to survive without one, you can't really get one right now. You know, it's very difficult and it's unsafe. Furthermore, so my heart really breaks for all of those artists that could have been and should have been real players in our industry who are just going to have to like do something else, give up and move home because it's just too hard to make the financials work. And it's going to be such a slow ramp back up into the fully humming industry that we were all enjoying before all of this. And that's not to be pessimistic. I think it's just a, you know, a realistic look at the class divide in the arts, that like there really is this problem where you have to come from a certain class or be incredibly lucky to support yourself. Like you, like there are going to be times when the ends just don't meet. And if you don't have a partner that is also working, if you don't have a family to support you, if you don't have, you know, just certain things that some people come into the arts without, it's desperately hard to keep going. And so I'm thinking about those people the most right now.
Okay. Andy, I mentioned the critic that I was talking to earlier today. It just reminded me, when you're in the theater, do you read and do you take seriously the comments of critics?
It depends. It depends on how much stake I have in it and what I'm hoping to get out of them. If it's about my acting, generally not. Because I understand, and this is an important point, I think, to bring. I think a lot of people don't understand this, is that any performance you see on stage or on film or whatever is a collaboration between the actor and the writer and the director and any number of producers. Like, there are notes coming in from all sides that, like, you know, maybe 30% of my performance to 50%, or, you know, up to 100% if I'm working with really great people who are open to my ideas. But like, that's what I'm in control of. But then I also have to do what I'm told by the writer, by the director, by the producer who's telling the director what to tell me, even if the director doesn't agree. You know, there's like a lot of voices, and performances are collaborations. And so, you know, I've definitely had experiences where I've been on stage knowing that I'm giving a performance that I don't fully understand, or that I know that I'm like doing a note, and if the review comes in and it's not flattering to me, I know that that's not completely on me, but at the same time, that's my name. So I find that's not that helpful. Like, as long as I've learned that as long as I am feeling like I have an opinion about what I'm doing, if I feel like I'm doing the homework and like bringing the life that's expected of me to the part, and if I'm taking everyone's notes, and if everyone internally is happy, and if my mm-hmm. scene partners are getting what they're getting, then, you know, it's completely subjective what anyone thinks of it. Now, if it's something that I've written, or I'm, you know, if I'm Michael's associate director on something, or, you know, then I'm actively looking, I'm in more control. And so I'm actively looking at what I can make better, because I know the story in my head. I know what I want it to look like, or I know what I want the audience to glean from this. But sometimes there's just that disconnect. Like, I know so much, and the audience is coming in with a totally fresh, mm-hmm. You know, blank perspective. And so if that's not connecting, there's actually something to really learn from a review. Like, what is someone who has no experience of this thing that I'm trying to put forward getting from what I'm putting out there? And then I'm able to like recalibrate for next time, if there's a next time. You know, if it's a book review or something like that, then like the book's written, so it's for the next book I write. But you know, if it's a show that like we're out of town and we're hoping to do it then again, and hopefully do it in New York later, there's really a lot to learn from those things, and it's actually mm-hmm. quite useful.
Andy, as a guy who analyzes, as you said you do, are you a person of hope when you look around the world?
Oh, that's a great question. It's hard right now to see, you know, obviously, we're going through a lot in this particular moment, but it's actually not any of it stuff that we haven't been through before. So what is troubling to me right now is the way that some people just seem so like willfully ignorant that you can point at the exact science, or you could point at the exact scripture even. And people just don't want to see it, that people don't want to open their eyes and ears and learn something, and maybe change their mind. That seems insurmountable to me, and that seems new. Like, and maybe it isn't, you know, maybe it's just because with the internet, with social media, like everything is more visible than it's ever been. Maybe this attitude has always been there, but this like dogmatic sort of tribal, you know, idea of like, these are my beliefs and they cannot change. They are immutable. And even if I'm seeing something that is proving to me that these ideas aren't working, or that they're flat out wrong, I just refuse to see the writing on the wall. I don't know how to change that. You know, I can like, mm-hmm. I can speak to anybody and tell them with perfect rationale. As you said, I'm an analytical person. I can like really lay out for them an idea, but if they're not, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make a drink. And so that's the part where I don't know how the world changes mm-hmm. if we can't hear each other. I am hopeful because I have to be. And I see, you know, like in this current moment of talking about racial justice in the way that we are, there's so much to do. There's so much to unpack and dismantle, but at the same time, more has happened in a couple of weeks than has happened in many decades. And, you know, we were having these conversations in 1968 and we're having them now, but something, you know, even like Black activists are saying that something feels different right now, that something, we have hit some kind of tipping point. And so I find hope in that. I find hope that, you know, as of a couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court has ruled that I cannot be fired in all 50 states just for being myself. That's a big deal. So, right, you know, right. Things do seem to be changing positively in certain ways. At the same time, they're being rolled back in other ways. And I hope that the arc of history bends toward justice for everybody. I don't know. I haven't been here that long. So I try to be hopeful.
I want to thank Andy for being with us. You know, Andy, we talked about your work as an actor and as a director, but we didn't get nearly enough into your work as a writer. So for our listeners around the country, Andy has a series of books aimed to young adults, the Backstagers, which is interesting, being written by a frontstager. Mm-hmm. But Andy, for people who want to know about your writing as well as the rest of your career, is there a website they should go to learn more?
There's not a website for me personally, but if you search for the Backstagers books, so there is a comic strip, or not a strip, a series of comic books, actually, mm-hmm. graphic novels called The Backstagers. And then there are books for middle grade readers, which are mine. So I did not write the comics, but I did write the books. They are published by Abrams Amulet, is the imprint. Amulet is the imprint of Abrams Books. So if you search all that, you will find the books there. They're also available wherever books are sold. You can find them on Amazon. You can find them at your local bookshop, which is probably better than Amazon. If they don't stock them, you can ask them to order them. That's always a good thing to do, your local independent bookstore. And they are, again, for middle grade readers, which is about 10 to 14 years old. I think that they could be read to readers that are younger than that. I think that readers much older than that could enjoy them if they enjoy theater and magic and friendship. And I am currently working on my debut for young adult readers, so slightly older than that. I have a book, it's not announced yet, this is the first place I've talked about it publicly, so I can't really give you any more information just yet, but I am working on a new book in a new series separate from the Backstagers for slightly older readers, and so people can keep their eyes peeled for that as well.
Andy, about 40 years ago, I did my first interview with the film director, Frank Capra, and that was the beginning of thousands of interviews where sometimes interviewing people is pulling teeth, and sometimes it's a delight if the person is open and willing to share their thought and their heart, and that second category is you. So thank you so much for being with us and just so openly sharing with us what you feel.
Thanks for having me.
No, it's great to have you, and enjoy your church as I'll enjoy mine, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now. As we end today's program, I want to thank you all for being with us. If you have any questions or comments about the show, you can send them to me through my website, which is www.closeencountertv.com. Personally Speaking is also available as a podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeart, and Spotify. I'm privileged to serve as host and executive producer of Personally Speaking. Our producer is Lisa Jandovitz. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be with you again next time on Personally Speaking.